This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is May 27th, 1999. I'm in Bascom Hall in the Provost's office where John Wiley and I are going to continue our interview about his years as graduate school dean. Let's talk about associate deans, the associate deans of the graduate school. First of all, generally, how are they chosen? How long do they normally serve? And traditionally, what are their duties?
Okay, I think I actually brought a piece of paper with me. I was thinking about this and doodling this morning, and you had sent me some advance warning of some of these questions,
mm-hmm.
Including a listing of associate deans,
right,
which I wanted to
here.
Amend a little bit
okay.
and correct. There's some additions. They're normally chosen on an as-needed basis when one of the positions is vacated for some reason, usually by a nomination and search process. Occasionally, there's someone who's just opportunistically right for the job, in the right place at the right time,
mm-hmm.
and there's the logical choice, and it's done without a search by just naming that person mm-hmm. to the position, but usually there's a search.
Mm-hmm.
And they're interesting enough positions that there's a fair bit of interest usually in having them, so lots of people get nominated and or apply.
Who nominates? Does anyone?
People apply themselves. Friends nominate them.
Okay.
Lots of departments seem to believe that there is a strategic advantage in having an associate dean in the grad school from your own department.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, as with most administrative positions, it probably works the other way around, that when you get in those positions, the importance of fairness,
mm-hmm.
and not only actual fairness, but the appearance of fairness, is so great that people bend over backwards to be fair and even-handed and actually often end up discriminating against their own department accidentally. So I'm not so sure that departments really feel in the end that they get what they thought they paid for when they got one of their own people into an administrative job, but there's usually a fair bit of interest in it.
What are the general duties of the, can you say what the general
sure.
duties are? Or
yeah, well, the duties, broadly speaking, are to act on behalf of the dean in all interactions with their division. These are you're talking about the faculty associate deans, the divisional associate deans, and I think we covered this on an earlier tape, but the grad school is organized by division, so there's one associate dean for each of the four divisions of the university. And most of their time really is spent dealing with things having to do with research support. They also serve as the campus facilitator or ombudsperson or conscience for issues having to do with faculty-student relations,
mm-hmm.
faculty-graduate-student
mm-hmm.
relations, so that if a graduate student gets into difficulty with his or her advisor and things aren't working out well, they appeal to the grad school, and the divisional associate dean usually is the one who steps in and mediates or tries to facilitate a resolution to the problem.
Mm-hmm. These
they
are
also deal with fellowships, graduate fellowships, including advanced opportunity mm-hmm. fellowships and WARF fellowships. They negotiate startup packages for new faculty in their division.
Mm. And these are half-time positions?
Yes.
Yeah. Did the duties of the associate deans change at all during your years as the dean?
No, I don't think so. I will say that one of the four positions is noticeably more complex and more difficult than the other three, and that's the biological sciences
mm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
Because, first of all, although it's not the biggest division in terms of number of faculty, that would be the social sciences division, it is the division that presents the most controversial and difficult problems. A lot of their research involves the use of research animals. That's a very controversial mm-hmm. topic.
Hmm.
Radioactive isotopes, radiation safety, human subjects research, clinical trials mm-hmm. for example involve human subjects. So there are lots of ethical issues that come up, and conflicts of interest
mm-hmm.
and so on that are dealt with by the associate dean for the biological sciences. I'd say that, as a matter of fact, as we'll probably get to this later, but for a while I had two half-time associate deans in the biological sciences. One for research animal issues,
Oh my.
And one for everything else.
Oh my. Who were the deans in place when you became associate deans? Excuse me, in place when you became dean.
I'm looking for the paper that I jotted things down. Okay. If I can find it quickly, I'll use it. Otherwise, I'll just reconstruct it.
I'll turn this.
When I first became dean, the associate deans were Marv Ebel for the physical sciences, Dean O. Smith. Dean was his name, not just
Dean
his title.
Dean Smith.
Dean Smith for the biological sciences. Barbara Stallings for the social sciences. And Ed Black was just finishing in the humanities as the associate dean for the humanities. But he wasn't actually occupying the office. He had finished his term, and although no one knew, had been appointed. So he was still technically the associate dean.
Mm-hmm.
He had more or less quit doing the job. He had gone back to his department.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I believe the very first thing I did as dean was interview the finalists for that for his replacement. They were down to just a few, and I don't remember who all of them were, but I chose Chuck Reed.
Mm.
And I remember interviewing him in the Memorial Union cafeteria at the big glass windows looking out over the lake. Had lunch with him and ended up selecting him. Then shortly after that, we were having lots of difficulties in the animal area.
Difficulties in the sense of?
Some units that were likely to not be accredited because of facility problems.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what all of the difficulties were, but we needed to put a lot of attention into that area, and we needed to develop, frankly, a campus-wide plan for how to deal with research animal issues and how to get all of the facilities up to snuff and
mm-hmm.
pay better attention to the protocols. The rules regarding the use of research animals were changing pretty rapidly, and we knew that we just needed to give it a lot more attention. So in consultation with Dean Smith, I decided to get another half-time person in to help with that and chose Janet Greger.
Mm.
And so the two of them more or less shared, well, they shared a title. Each was half-time. I don't remember if they shared an office or not. They may have shared an office too, at least for a while,
mm-hmm.
And divided the day so that one was there in the morning and the other in the mm-hmm. afternoon or something. But Janet did just that for maybe 1 or 2 years. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, she wasn't there for too long.
She was there for quite a while.
Yeah, she was there for 4 years. Barbara Stallings was only there for a year.
Yeah, Barbara left the university altogether about within a year or so after
mm-hmm.
I came up
mm-hmm.
there. I hope I didn't drive her out. We really tried hard to keep her. And then she was replaced with Martin Cadwallader.
Mm-hmm.
And Martin has been the associate dean for the social sciences ever since.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he has the longest tenure of anyone up there now as
mm-hmm.
an associate
mm-hmm.
dean. Marv Ebel, until that time, had held the record for length of service as associate dean, I think.
Well, I'd like you to just characterize the contributions briefly of some of these people.
Okay.
Marv Ebel was a very interesting person. I found his retirement notice, and he had two pages, and one dealing with his being on the faculty as member of, what was it, the physics department?
Yes, physics.
Yeah. And the other one was as associate dean of the graduate school, and he had been there for 18 years.
Yes.
It's amazing.
He was absolutely wonderful and very, very difficult to replace because he had so much institutional memory and so much expertise. He was also the, I don't want to say curmudgeon, he was the acid test. If we had a new idea for how to do something differently, Marv could always give the five best reasons why we shouldn't do it. So once I got something by Marv, I was pretty sure it was a good idea and it was
mm-hmm.
going to work
mm-hmm.
because he really made us think hard about all the negatives before we would mm-hmm. agree to do something. Not that he was stuck in the mud. I don't mean
no,
to
I understand,
imply that.
Yeah.
But he was just very good at looking at second and third order unanticipated consequences of changes. He also was a very strong advocate for the very highest academic standards. So anytime we talked about lightening or loosening a rule, Mm-hmm. We had to spend a long time talking about why we had that rule, mm-hmm. and what value it had and what purpose it served and what would happen if it weren't there, and so on. So Marv was wonderful. He also had a very strong national reputation and had made a lot of contributions on the national scale, affected a lot of legislation. He was instrumental in working on behalf of COGR, the Committee on Government Relations, to influence Office of Management and Budget rules on the implementation of what's called A21. It's the federal guidelines for how indirect costs are calculated, yeah. and so on. He was an expert on indirect cost calculations.
I see that on his little thing here.
And was involved in a lot of the negotiations for our campus on what our indirect cost rate would be.
He was also known nationally in the area of research administration.
Yes.
What exactly is research administration?
Well, it's all of the nitty-gritty stuff that you have to do to satisfy the federal regulations.
Oh, my.
When you get money from them for research projects. So it starts with the pre-proposal stage, making sure that you've addressed all of the issues and concerns in the proposal you send to the agency, and that you've put in all of your assurances and mm-hmm. everything that's required. Dealing with the agency and negotiating anything that needs to be negotiated, and then once the award is made, making sure that the funds are used exactly as in compliance with all those regulations.
Dean Reed was your first, the first dean you hired, and I believe he was there throughout your entire
yes, he
deanship.
Was.
Do you want to talk about Charles Reed for
sure.
a moment?
Sure, he was a gem. In fact, I must say that all the associate deans that I worked with in the grad school were just absolutely first rate. They were terrific. And they had different personalities, but they worked well together. They could cover for each other in the across divisional lines when necessary. Obviously, someone in the humanities wouldn't have the full scope of or depth of understanding of the biological sciences, but he could step in if Dean or Janet were gone and help someone for the biological division with a problem, and vice versa. They could, all permutations of mm-hmm. those four people could do it, or those five people. But getting back to Chuck particularly, he was had a very good knowledge of the humanities division. He also, interestingly enough, had as his closest collaborator, now remember, Chuck is a professor of English and linguistics.
Mm-hmm.
His closest collaborator is an electrical engineer, Paul Milankovic, and so he knew a fair bit about the physical sciences division from his interactions with Paul. Also, he was a former member of a pit crew in a NASCAR racing team.
I didn't know that.
And he's actually a pretty good mechanic. Is unusual humanist.
Yeah,
okay?
right. Very unusual.
He really worked tirelessly for the humanities division, and I think they probably owe him a lot more than they know. I lost my train of thought. What was the general question?
The general question was just to characterize the contributions of the different
of the
deans,
deans,
and that
okay.
was our next one.
The humanities associate dean also usually is the one who has responsibility for overseeing the university press and the Institute for Research mm-hmm. on Humanities, although it's lodged within LNS administratively. It interacts a fair bit with the grad school.
Mm-hmm.
Something called the Newberry Library, which we contribute to and belong to. Each one of those jobs has certain, I won't remember them all, but certain mm-hmm. specific duties that go beyond the generic duties of the job. And those are some of the ones in the humanities mm-hmm. division. The physical sciences division associate dean has day-to-day responsibility for looking after all of the research institutes and centers in that division. That would include the Space Science and Engineering mm-hmm. Center, the Synchrotron Radiation Center, the Physical Sciences Laboratory, the Water Resources Center, I believe. Maybe some others I'm forgetting. Biological division has too many to name. The Enzyme Institute, the Weissman Center,
mm-hmm.
Lab for Molecular Biology, the Institute of Virology, Environmental Toxicology Center, the Cell and Molecular Biology degree program. That's, as I said before, undoubtedly the biggest job.
You said that you brought in Janet Greger to work with Dean Smith. Could you talk about the two of them separately and as a group? As a whole?
This one will need to be embargoed.
Okay, we'll embargo the thing.
Okay. They're both terrific in their own ways. But I will say that in that position, more so even than the dean's position, or any other administrative positions on campus, the associate dean for the biological sciences is, in some ways, seems to be a burnout position. Mm. It's a job that eats you up. You seem to come into it with a certain amount of goodwill and credit across the campus, and you use it up daily until it's all gone, after which you have to move on.
There you are.
I mean, that's the way it works.
Yeah.
The biologists, it's such a competitive part of the campus in terms of getting research funding. As far as I can tell, almost every biologist, certainly almost every basic biologist on campus, truly believes that they're, if things just fall right, they will be in line for a Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
And so the stakes are very high.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that may not be literally true, but that's the way it feels and the way it seems to behave. So the people in that division are not as understanding and civil with each other when they don't get exactly what they want, exactly when they want it. Just to give you an example of what I mean by that, we have an annual research competition for research funding that comes ultimately from WRF.
Mm-hmm.
Biologists are keenly aware that the lion's share, not as big a fraction as they believe, but they know that a very considerable amount of that money is traceable to patents in the biological sciences. And so, in a sense, they feel like it's really their money.
Mm-hmm.
And they grudgingly and reluctantly allow the campus to share it with the other divisions. So with that as background, we have this competition. We get about 700 or more applications every year. They're reviewed by the research committees that are chaired by those four associate deans. And then decisions are made, and letters are sent out telling people what they got,
mm-hmm.
whether they were funded or not, and if so, how much. After those letters are received and digested, the return mail starts coming in. Phone calls, emails, and letters. In the humanities division, the letters are often handwritten on flowered stationery or greeting cards that have been purposefully purchased for this and thought out, and they're effusive. What a wonderful thing it is that I got $5,000. This will make such a difference in my career. I can't tell you how important this is to me. And on and on and on. Thank you so much. I'll never forget how good the grad school was to me. In the biological sciences, the grousing comes in. I asked for $45,000 and you only gave me $40. How do you expect me to do anything with this? What's wrong with you idiots?
Mm.
It's just on and on in that vein. So, and Dean and Janet and others who have done that job characterize it as their hate mail.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some cultural differences across the campus that seem very stable and consistent from year to year.
How long Janet was able to, how long were they able to stay? Did they burn out?
Well, let me continue then. You
okay.
asked me to be candid about Dean and Janet and how they worked separately and together. Dean, by the time I got there, had been associate dean for quite some time, and it was, I think, becoming clear to him, and it soon became clear to me from the complaints I was getting mm-hmm. from the biological sciences division that they didn't feel, see, each division thinks that their associate dean is up there to advocate
mm-hmm.
for them,
mm-hmm.
and if they're not getting as much as they want out of the grad school, it's because their advocate is failing, is not being strong enough. It's not true, but that's the way they view it. And so the complaining about Dean was that he didn't understand the division anymore, that he wasn't as effective as he should be in advocating for them. They really needed a new face. And so I had the rather unpleasant job shortly after he had told me how much he enjoyed doing this job and how he intended to continue for as long as we mutually agreed it was useful. Within literally days or a week or two, I had to have a talk with him and say, I really think it's time to move on. And in my judgment, he was doing a very good job, actually. Mm-hmm. But if you lose the confidence of your constituents or the people you're serving, it
doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter, yeah. Right. So he did that. He moved on back to the Department of Physiology. And I decided that Janet had gotten the research animal issues under such good control that I would just not replace Dean and let Janet do the full job, because the animal issues had fallen down to a lower level of hysteria. And we did hire a new veterinarian for the campus that really was very good, Christine Parks. She's still on the job, and she helped tremendously to get things under control. So Janet did the entire job then for a while. And eventually went the way of Dean. I mean, just kind of used up her credit. And when Virginia Hinshaw became Dean, it didn't take too long before her judgment was pretty much the same as mine about Dean.
Being at the same time,
to move on.
Interesting.
And
did Janet understand that?
Not entirely, no. And I'll say this about Janet. She is unbelievably competent, beyond human belief. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you the number of times that she came to me with an analysis of a situation or an issue or a recommendation or a judgment that didn't seem quite right to me at first. It didn't add up. Never once did she turn out to be wrong. Never once on any issue, big or small. Mm-hmm. She was just 100% accurate. You couldn't possibly have a better advisor in a very difficult, complicated area. That's not my area. My area is the physical sciences.
Right.
But her judgment about people, her judgment about likely directions, her judgment about what agencies would do was just, as far as I could tell, perfect.
Hmm.
She also, like Marv Ebel, developed quite a national reputation. She served on a lot of NIH panels. She became the COGER representative after Marv retired.
The what representative? I'm sorry.
COGER.
The COGER. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And has more expertise today than anyone else on campus on the kinds of issues that Marv was expert on. But she simply could not continue as associate dean in the grad school. There were too many people grousing about this or that. Someone once explained it to me by saying that when you're in that job, and I think they actually generalized it to academic administration, every decision you make creates one ingrate and one enemy.
What a thought.
and they accumulate.
Yeah.
So Janet moved on, and Tim Mulcahy was chosen to replace her, and he's been doing it since then. I think he's been at it about 4 or 5 years, maybe a little bit longer. I don't remember exactly.
Uh-oh, he's getting...
Well, I haven't heard lately. Tim has an unusual... Let me before I move to Tim, let me acknowledge one thing about Janet that was a problem. Janet is, despite what I said about her unerring accuracy, she has a style that puts people off, and I must say, especially men. She is blunt to the point of rudeness sometimes. I frankly appreciate that style because sometimes it's hard to get through to me. If I've got my mind made up about something, you almost need to hit me over the head with a 2x4 to get my attention before I'll listen to your reasons why I'm wrong.
And she possessed
and
a 2x4. Yeah.
She absolutely could do that. And other people will just defer and say, okay, you're right, and go away. And they'll let me do something that's wrong. Janet wouldn't do that.
Well, you had some good checks and balances then with Marv Ebel and Janet.
Absolutely.
That's great.
Yeah, it was a great team. So she's got this style that is sometimes abrasive and rubs people the wrong way. And I could never completely sort out how much of it was real, and some of it was, and how much of it was overt sexism. In other words, men reacting to her because of her bluntness and her sometimes her crudeness and her tough talk, what they would have admired in a man, they resented in a woman. And so I always discounted some of the criticism, but eventually I think Ginger felt she couldn't discount all of it.
And change was made.
And Tim, in contrast, is the consummate diplomat. I don't think he rubs anyone the wrong way. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but he's just very smooth, a real politician when he needs to be, and very competent too, as Janet was. So he may, his credit may last a little longer.
Martin Cadwalader came aboard in 1991 and stayed through the rest of your deanship. Could you talk for a moment about him?
Well, I would say the same thing about Martin that I said about Chuck Reed. He's, I think he quickly got and has held the respect of the entire social sciences division, and in fact the other divisions as well, and the other associate deans. He's a very, very good, wise advisor. He's been around campus long enough to know the campus really well, knows a significant fraction of all the faculty. So, as a matter of fact, shortly after we finish this interview, before I leave for my next appointment, I'm going to go talk to him to get some suggestions for a particular committee that I have to appoint, because some of the people that will be on this committee are from his division, and he'll know more of the nitty-gritty details than I do. Even though I may know them casually from receptions, I won't know that if you put these two individuals on the same committee, you're going to have fireworks or, you know.
Another nice person to have around.
Yes.
Terrence Millar was an acting associate dean for a few years.
Yes.
I couldn't quite get a...
Let's see now. I'm going to try to reconstruct how it all happened. Marita can help you with this, too. Marita Weiss. We had some kind of crisis or another out at the Physical Sciences Lab, Synchrotron Radiation Center. These are difficult units to run. And... for different reasons. The SRC is a classic Wisconsin operation. It's world class, the best of its class, with a budget. Well, let me start by saying it was the very first synchrotron radiation light source anywhere in the world. It was the prototype of all such centers that followed anywhere. It was built Aladdin, the one that we, the accelerator that we have now, was built for about $13 million. As far as I know, the second cheapest one that's in operation anywhere in the world today costs over $100 million to build. And the budget, the annual operating budget of SRC, is about $3 million, in contrast to multiple tens of millions at the other centers like Brookhaven National Light Source, or one in Berkeley and one in Argonne and so on. And yet the amount of science that comes out of this is every bit the equal in volume and quality of those other centers. So it's a very thinly administered, very economically run. But that means it's always on the razor's edge. If anything goes wrong, it becomes a crisis. Just like the campus as a whole, always on a starvation diet. And the PSL, the other unit out there, Physical Sciences Lab, is basically a service unit that has to pay most of its own way by selling its services. And like any business, any service business, there are cycles. And so they go through fat and lean times pretty predictably and periodically. They can go from running a surplus in their budget to a big deficit back to a surplus a few years later. And we don't have any really good mechanisms in the university to maintain substantial, what are they called, buffer funds to get through the slumps. So every now and then they get into a crisis, and sometimes it's worse than others. I removed the director, Murray Thompson, for a variety of reasons, not just budgetary, personnel administration and other things, and some really bad decisions about what to invest in that he did in a willful way against everyone's advice. And so we needed a director, and I got Marv to do that on an interim basis. And I believe it was at that time that we brought Terry in, on an interim basis mm-hmm. to take over the duties as associate dean in the physical sciences. Mm-hmm. He served with the title interim associate dean in the physical sciences for quite a long time. Marv ultimately retired without ever coming back to full associate dean service in the grad school. And so Terry was simply made permanent.
Hmm. He was made permanent without a search and...
I have to say that he is he's a delight. Terry is a mathematician. He's a logician. He works in the fundamentals of mathematics or something like that, but it's logic and the foundations mm-hmm. that's the term he uses. And is an expert in recursive algorithms. He speaks a hybrid language that you have to get used to, which is a combination of English and mathematical terminology. He does this in everyday conversation as well as in any other setting.
I love it.
And so you just have to get used to his style of communication, yeah. which
I'll bet.
Which I like, and other people find either irritating or amusing.
Mm-hmm.
But he's one of these guys who has an idea a minute, and he works so hard and so long that not only will he have the idea today, he will have it implemented by tomorrow, whether it was a good idea or not.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are, as mm-hmm. a matter of fact. So he's been a real asset, I think, mm-hmm. to the grad school and to the campus in terms of his creativity and kludging up solutions to very difficult problems.
Now, you have some very unique individuals on your committee here, associate deans. How did they interact as a whole with you? Did you have much interaction, or were you all sort of off doing
your
thing?
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of interaction. The only friction that I can recall was occasionally Janet, because of her style, mm-hmm. would get crossways with one or another of the others. By and large, they all got along really well at all times, in all combinations. The only times I can remember hearing complaints are having someone ask me to intervene, usually involved Janet.
Hmm. Was she able, would she understand the criticism? And
yeah, usually. But I really admire her greatly, so mm-hmm. I'm trying to be as candid and honest with you for the historic record as I can, but I want to also put on the record that some of this is very understandable. She came up from through the ranks in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, which when she first joined, and in fact to this day, is mostly male, mm-hmm. and it has a, as far as I can see, sort of 19th century culture, very male dominated. Mm-hmm. She had a rough time. She took a lot of behavior from her colleagues that today would be actionable, would be considered illegal sexual harassment. And so she was, if I criticized her for doing something, her first thought was always, okay, now what if a man had done that? What would mm-hmm. you be saying? And so sometimes she would fight back a little bit on those grounds. Usually I thought a little bit unfairly that it wasn't really a sexist reaction, but sometimes I caught myself
mm-hmm.
criticizing her for things mm-hmm. that I probably wouldn't have. You know, it was just, it's habit for all of us,
That's
I guess.
Right. Yeah.
And so I tried to be extra understanding of her because of her path to the grad school and the things she had overcome to get there.
Let's switch the topic of conversation and talk about Wharf. Wharf is just such a key element, and Wharf funding is just so important to the greatness of this university. Basically, every year Wharf allots a certain amount of money to the graduate school for research purposes. For the background, for somebody listening to this 50 years from now, who sets that amount? Who's involved with the process? Does the graduate students, graduate school, or do you as dean, or did you as dean, have any input into that initial aspect of the?
Well, not much. The dean of the graduate school is the primary contact person for Wharf, mm-hmm. just because the graduate school was chosen at the time that Wharf was established as the unit of the university that would administer the funds
mm-hmm.
that they give us. Again, just for the historic record, I'm sure even 50 years from now or longer, people will know what WARF is, but they're our patenting and licensing agent. They've had a number of very successful patents and that made a lot of money in royalty income, and then they've also invested it very well. Mm-hmm. In fact, I once heard the former director of WARF, John Pike, describing to a delegation from another university how they could create a WARF. We do get visited every few weeks mm-hmm. by delegations mm-hmm. from around the world asking how does it work and how can we set one up. And John's prescription was very simple. He said, you start 75 years ago, you have some very some blockbuster patents early on, make a lot of money, and you invest it well through the Depression. That's the prescription for WARF. And the message, of course, was it's not easy to replicate these yeah. days. And I don't believe there's any other university that has anything even remotely mm-hmm. like it. There are lots of universities that have patenting and licensing offices, usually within the university. There are also others that use outside agencies, like the Research Corporation, as their patenting and licensing arm. But I don't know of another university that has a foundation just like WARF. There may be some. I just don't happen to know, and I've never tried to find out. But I think, personally, that the part of the success of WARF is due to the fact that it is independent of the university. It's run entirely by a board of directors that's self-perpetuating. Mm-hmm. They choose their own new members when current members retire or die. And they pick the executive director, who then manages it and picks the staff. There is absolutely zero university control or access to its internal workings and books.
Or state government control.
Or state government control. It's a fully standalone, independent, that's not 501c3 corporation, but it's incorporated under a older tax law that no mm-hmm. longer exists. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is important because I'm told by company representatives that WARF is almost uniquely respected among licensees, companies that mm-hmm. license the patents, for their ability to maintain confidentiality and negotiate in a professional way, which they could not do if these licensees were negotiating mm-hmm. with the university. All of our records are public documents. Mm-hmm. We would not be able to keep their secrets secret.
That's right.
Often companies don't even want their competitors to know what technologies they're licensing, what ones they're interested in. Never mind the details of them, not even the fact that they have an interest in that area. And we could not maintain that kind of confidentiality within the university, and shouldn't. So it's very valuable to have an outside organization that can do that on our behalf.
Mm-hmm.
The trustees determine the amount that they give us each year, and they do it in a way that's determined partly by the tax code and partly by their own policy decisions. Tax law, I'm not going to remember the exact numbers, but the tax law requires a foundation of their kind to distribute, consistent with its charter. In this case, it means distribute to the mm-hmm. university.
Mm-hmm.
We're the only potential beneficiaries or recipients of their money and their charter. They can only give to the University of Wisconsin, Madison. They must distribute each year a formula amount, and it's something like either 3% of their net worth or all of the current year income, whichever is
mm-hmm.
greater.
Mm.
It's something like that. I don't remember the exact numbers, but there's a rule of that sort. And so that's what the tax law requires. And then above and beyond that, they recognize that royalty income is very noisy. You'll get a lot in one year and not very much the next mm-hmm. year and so on. So it fluctuates wildly. And to make sure that the amount they give us is more predictable from year to year so that we can plan on it and budget for what we're going to get, they use a 5-year rolling average formula. So they run their numbers, decide how much they should give us, and they tell us in the fall of each year, I believe. They give us a planning number. They say, it looks like this year we'll probably be able to give you $15 million. So why don't you come back to us next spring with a budget that's about that amount and show us what you would do with it. Then in the spring meeting, they say, okay, the exact amount will be, and they make it accurate, and it's never less than their planning amount. It's either that much or
nice.
More. So there's usually a little bit extra. And sometimes, even beyond that, they'll say, now if there's some special needs, we'd like to hear about those. No promises. We can't guarantee that we would give you any more, but if you had something unusual going on, we would consider a request for an additional amount.
Would this be like bricks and mortar type requests, or?
Yes, or other things like the synchrotron.
Like the $1 million that Irv requested for, Irv Shane requested for. When you were dean, what were you average? What did you get per year about from Wharf dollars?
Well, interestingly enough, for as long as I've tracked these numbers, it seems to have run about 4% of our gross research expenditures for the year. And so it's grown at about the same rate as the overall research expenditures, although it constitutes only about 4%.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. And how much does that translate to?
Well, it was in the a little bit less than 15 to as much as a little bit over $20 million a year during my time as dean of the grad school.
I've interviewed many, many professors over during the 10 years I've been on this project, and very distinguished ones, and so many of them have said to me that it was Wharf. It was the Wharf on Josh Lederberg as an example.
Yes.
It was those early grants when they were young and they didn't know where else to go that really got them off the ground. Is that viewed as part of the Wharf mission?
Yes, absolutely. And I think they're right. For two reasons. Of the money that we get, the lion's share is given out in research competition.
Mm-hmm.
But I shouldn't have said given out. It's awarded in the research competition. There are almost always strings attached. And the two most important kinds of strings are contingent grants and insurance grants. A contingent grant would be like this. The proposer or the requester says, I've applied for a Fulbright fellowship, and if I get it, I'll spend a year in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fulbright will pay two-thirds of my salary, but I'll need to get the other third from somewhere. I'm applying for that other third. And so if that's awarded, the research committee says, if you get the Fulbright, we will pay the other third.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't get it, we pay nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the contingent grant. The insurance grant is as follows. Someone writes in and says, I want to do a research project on X. Here's my plan, here's what I'm going to do, and I would like $25,000 from the research committee to do it. If that is awarded, the letter is likely to say, we'll provide $25,000 if and only if you apply to the National Science Foundation or the NIH or something, they'll name an agency, and you're turned down.
Oh. Mm.
If you get the money from them, then you won't need our money.
Insurance.
Yeah. That way, the person knows that they're, one way or the other, they're going to have at least that much money, and they can plan their program and make a commitment to a graduate student or whatever, or have some summer salary. But some fraction of those don't actually get paid out.
Mm-hmm.
So the committee awards a larger amount of money than they actually intend to pay. Just statistically, they know that some of it will come back.
Mm-hmm.
During the year then, the associate deans in the graduate school use that money that came back to help provide startup packages for new faculty, to give them, even without a proposal, some flexible funds to use to start their research program or to buy equipment or whatever, or to provide stipends for graduate students or provide summer salary for the first couple of summers before they get extramural grants. So the money gets recycled in a very creative way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other element of this that's very valuable to the campus is that no one gets anything by entitlement. Everyone is required to compete for it. And the proposals that come in are peer-reviewed by experts in the area or in as close an area as we can find and discussed by the research committee and the associate deans. And if the proposal is deemed to be something that's not worth doing or not well thought out or not well planned, they turn it down. So it hones the competitiveness of all the faculty on campus. And that's something that does not occur at other universities. There's no internal peer review mechanism. And so people learn the hard way with external peer review when they apply to federal agencies. Here you can practice on internal peer review. Not only that, the research committee members and the associate deans do very candid mentoring of new faculty, particularly, make suggestions for improvement in their proposals, and suggest colleagues that they might want to get ideas on various parts of their research proposal and so on. So it really, I think, greatly improves the overall competitiveness of the campus, and it's very good. We have about a 50% success rate with all the proposals that go out of this campus.
Wow.
And many agencies have something like 10% success rates nationwide.
What about that hard science versus soft science thing in Wharf? Now, early on in Wharf, you just got money for the, quote, hard sciences. And then in, with Fred Harvey Harrington and the that whole thing, there was a change. And is there a percentage? Are things divided, determined on a percentage basis? Is there do conflicts arise because of that? Is it still an issue?
No. Well, it's not much of an issue. I said earlier that the biologists grouse a little bit, that a bigger fraction should go to them because that's where the money came from. My answer to them usually was that if we awarded Wharf money in exact proportion to where it came from, most of it would go to, in any given year, to either biochemistry or medical physics or some a handful, not more than a dozen departments that in any given year have active royalty-producing patents. And many of the departments that complained the loudest have never generated a penny of Wharf money. So I was not very sympathetic with that argument. And in fact, what we do is we give exactly the same instructions to every division. When the proposals are all in and divided by division, we add up the total amount of money requested. Then we know how much we have to award. And historically, in the last 10 years or so, we've usually had enough money to grant about 40% of what was requested. So we tell every committee, you should end the year after you've given out, reviewed all your proposals in your division and awarded whatever was awarded, you should have approved about 40% of the dollars requested. So they all get exactly the same instructions. Now, it's true that the proposals in the biological sciences particularly, and to some extent the physical sciences, tend to be for larger amounts of money. And so the lion's share of the dollars go to the biological and physical sciences. But it's an identical percentage of what was requested. There are also interesting differences in the way the money's used. Cultural differences, again, by division. In the sciences, the money is used mostly to support graduate students and to buy equipment and supplies.
Expensive equipment.
Often expensive equipment. And in the social sciences and humanities, the humanities more so than the social sciences, it is used largely for faculty summer salary. There are reasons for that, though. The biological division is very heavily influenced by Cal's and the med school, and they have 12-month appointments, so faculty salaries are provided from the base budget of the department. In the humanities, division-wide, the salaries are lower, and furthermore, they have no source of summer support. So it's either this or nothing. So there are reasons for it. But there are those differences that are quite noticeable when you look at the overall summary statistics after the season is over.
Wharf Board, I was talking to Dean Reed, and he said that during your administration, there was a dramatic change in the graduate school's relationship with the Wharf Board. Do you know what he's referring to? And if so, could you talk a little bit about the kind of relationship that you sought to establish with the Wharf Board?
Yeah. When I was first selected, one of the early visitors was John Pike, who at that time was the executive director of Wharf. And he told me that it was his hope that we could do some damage control or repair the relations with the board. Bob Bach, who was my predecessor and who was dean of the grad school for 22 years, believed very strongly and wasn't shy about saying it that Wharf should give us more money than they do every year. And he would regularly present them analyses showing them how stingy they were. At its base, the issue is just the same issue that you and I would have with our personal finances. The question, how much money do you put in your checking account versus how much you put in your savings account? And the Wharf trustees are very conservative. They had took a very long view of their role and their impact on the campus. And they put as much as they could under the tax laws into the savings account, basically, into investments. Had they not done that, had they just paid out the maximum they could every year, we wouldn't be getting anything like $15 or $20 million a year now. We'd be getting next to nothing. And it would fluctuate wildly from year to year. In contrast, right now, Wharf is sitting on, I can't say the exact amount, but it's well in excess of $1 billion in investments. Well in excess. It's by far the biggest endowment that this university has. And it's largely the earnings on that endowment that come back to us year in and year out, not the current year earnings on royalty, on patents. So I think, frankly, they made a good decision, although I can tell you that anyone sitting in the chair of the dean of the graduate school would always like to have more to distribute, because most of the noise that comes back is complaints about things that people can't do because they don't have enough money, and they look to the graduate school as their banker to provide the money, and if you don't provide it, they tell you all the reasons why you should have taken it away from someone else and given it to them. And so that causes most of the day-to-day aggravation, and it certainly would be an easier job if you had an unlimited amount of money. But I'm quite sure that if you doubled the Wharf gift, the same problems would still be there at twice the magnitude. That's and so I took the attitude that I would not spend a lot of time grousing at the trustees about their stinginess, and instead focus on giving them very detailed reports about all the exciting things we're doing with the gift, and that that would encourage them to be a little bit more generous when they felt it was fiscally wise to do it. And that worked.
I can't remember exactly where I heard this, but I remember someone telling me that the way Dean Bach operated is he would go down to these meetings by himself, and it was, again, this sort of almost clandestine type of approach, and that you opened that up a lot. And I'm trying to remember if I heard this correctly. Somebody said you got the chancellor involved with that too. Is
yes.
that?
Well, I wouldn't say that I got the chancellor.
Or
involved.
How did that?
I mean, she was interested. Donna Shalala was interested in being involved, and we talked about this strategy. She and I did, and David Ward, and it was a conscious strategy. It wasn't just mine. We thought about it and talked about it a lot, and decided that another component of the strategy would be to get the Wharf trustees more familiar with the campus, what was going on in the campus. So she initiated a practice of having an annual dinner jointly with them. She invited them to Olin House to have a dinner and to thank them for their contributions to the university. A lot of them individually, by the way, are also donors to the UW Foundation and have endowed things on the campus. And they reciprocated by inviting us to a dinner. So every other year, we hosted on campus, or they hosted at the Madison Club or something like that. We also started the practice of, when we had the dinner at Olin House, we would invite all the associate deans so that the trustees got to meet them. And often we invited other people that we thought would be interesting to them. Hector DeLuca is someone that they took a great interest in because he's been one of our most prolific inventors, and so they often take the initiative to arrange separate meetings with him. But we got them to meet lots of faculty from around the campus, and I think they feel much more connected and much more a part of the place now than when they just fly into Madison for a one-day meeting, meet in the Wharf building behind closed doors, and disappear again.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And Bach stonewalled them. They wanted reports on what the money was being used for on the campus. And for all practical purposes, he told them it was none of their business. He showed me his notes for going to one of those meetings, and it was on a 3x5 card. This isn't widely known around the campus, and I'm not sure I would want it to be for a variety of reasons, but we provide them with a rather elaborate, detailed report on all the uses of the WRF money, and it's both written and oral.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice a change in the board's attitude toward you and toward the university as you got to know each other?
Oh, yeah. They're very friendly and cordial now, and responsive to special requests and so on. The board is also in a transition now. When I first went up to the grad school, there were a few members that were among the original trustees, if you can imagine that. They had been on the board for its entire existence, and that meant that they were in their 90s. And some of them I'm using my words carefully. They weren't always fully alert. They didn't always know exactly what was going on. I don't know that they were clinically senile, but they were not as sharp as they once were. Let's put it that way. Also, some of them were living in the past and didn't like some of the changes they saw in society in general or in the university in particular, and they let us know that. As some of those folks have left the board and died, the new replacements are from a whole new generation. They're much, much younger. I think probably the youngest person on the board when I first started meeting with them was in his 70s.
Wow.
And now we've got people that are in their 50s, maybe even 40s, on the board.
Let's talk for a little bit about duplication, eliminating duplicate programs. I'm not as interested in going into individual programs per se as the total review process that you established to deal with this issue. Could you talk about what review process did you use to determine whether a program should be phased out, and you know, how that whole thing was undertaken by you and your staff?
Well, as you probably have heard from other people, one of my nicknames in the grad school was the Data Dean.
Yeah, I have it right here.
and I like to do my own analyses. Yeah. So my favorite tool is the spreadsheet. And there's very little that I can't do with a spreadsheet. But I entered that job with a certain amount of trepidation because I had spent my entire career here on campus in the College of Engineering, frankly not paying a whole lot of attention to the rest of the campus. Mm-hmm. Certainly I had almost no contact or understanding of the biological sciences, and really, honestly, not much with the social sciences or humanities either. I thought I knew the physical sciences division pretty well. And so the trepidation was that I would A, make a fool of myself, or B, make some really bad mistakes that would seriously cripple one of the other divisions by doing dumb things. So I set out to learn as much as I could. And a lot of what I saw early on didn't make much sense. Things as simple as the number of departments and the average size of departments, or the distribution of department sizes by division. If you look at it even today, we have vastly more named things in the biological sciences than in any other division. And if you compare us to other campuses, peer campuses, like Berkeley and Michigan in particular, we always try to compare ourselves to Berkeley and Michigan, because among the public schools, we consider them to be peers in a way that a school like Ohio State, for example, is not. So in benchmarking against them, some things leaped out at me. One is that we've divided ourselves a lot more finely than they have. We have a lot more departments, and that means that since we're roughly the same size as those campuses, that means that on the average our units are smaller. And just from an abstract point of view, that's inherently less efficient. There are certain core services that easily could be shared among those departments, or that would naturally be shared if they were merged. So it was that pretty naive thought that drove the process. I thought we would improve our competitiveness if we merged some of the smaller departments or programs into a smaller number of larger units, and that they would be better served that way, and so on. Let me give an analogy. Everybody's noticed what a dramatic difference it made at the airports and banks when they stopped forcing every teller to serve a single line, and instead had a pool waiting for service, and the next person in the pool is served by the next available server. It's easy to prove, and statisticians assign this as a homework problem, to prove that that's a very much more efficient way of getting service. You get much better service that way. The average wait time is much lower. So the concept is that two departments of 10 faculty. Yeah, let me start over and rephrase it. I want to make a comparison between two different situations. On the one hand, you have two departments of 10 faculty, and let's say that each of those departments has two secretaries that are serving the 10 faculty. So altogether, we have 20 faculty and four secretaries. If you were to merge those two departments to have a single department of 20 faculty with four secretaries, it's easy to show that everyone would get better and faster service. As a matter of fact, with those specific numbers, they would probably still get better and faster service with only three secretaries. So that was a very simple, naive thought that drove a lot of the early efforts to get departments and other units to think about merging or reducing duplication by working together better and so on. I think there's still something to that, and we did accomplish a little bit along those lines, but not nearly as much as I thought we would. And I'm not convinced anymore that that we should have done most of what I thought we should do. I now see a lot more advantage in a certain amount of healthy duplication than I would have at the time. I'll give you an example there too. If you just look at the names of our departments, you'll see that we have a Department of Journalism, we have a Department of Agricultural Journalism, we have a program in human ecology called Family and Consumer Journalism. Looks like we have three or more journalism departments. We have a Department of Biochemistry, a Department of Chemistry, a Department of Chemical Engineering, a Department of Biomolecular Chemistry, and a department called Nutritional Science that's populated by nothing but biochemists. So what do we have? Does that mean we have five chemistry departments of some description or another? Those were the kinds of observations that I was making early on. But as a matter of fact, there's a sufficiently different focus in those departments and a sufficiently different mission that it actually does make some sense to have them separated for a variety of reasons. And also, a real challenge that we've had in the last 5 or 10 years has been hiring faculty who cannot be hired unless we can also hire the spouse. Spousal hires have become a big issue. And these are difficult to do because Department A has gone through a search process and found the one person they want. And so we're going to try to make an offer to that person, but the spouse comes along automatically with that person, and no one has gone through a search to identify the spouse. The spouse comes out of thin air. And may or may not be in an area that any department on campus is interested in hiring in, and may not be of a quality that they want, and so on. I can tell you if that spouse that needs placing is an astronomer, we're dead in the water. The chances in any given year of adding another person to a very small, highly specialized department like astronomy is almost zero. On the other hand, if the spouse to be placed is some form of biochemist, we'll have four or five or six places to try, and we've got a much better chance of placing them in a department that really wants them. So a certain amount of duplication is actually healthy, I now believe.
Well, that's fun. What about the state schools? do they cause problems in this area, especially since merger? Does UWM have programs that are really duplicates of programs here? Do you take that into consideration?
No, not at all.
Deal with system at all?
No, the system administration worries a lot about it. But I have to say, in all honesty, that it hasn't been at all a problem for the Madison campus, in the sense that they have never, in my memory, told us that we could not develop some program that we wanted to develop because they already had one at Eau Claire or something like that. On the other hand, very much to the benefit of Madison, system administration has prevented every other campus except Milwaukee from having doctoral programs. And that would be where we would get into serious competitive issues.
Yeah.
So my view is that system administration has actually been very helpful for the Madison campus in preventing a form of duplication that would be problematic for us.
Do you have associations with, or did you, as dean, with the dean of the graduate school from UWM,
oh, yes.
For example?
Yes.
That's the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Yes. The provosts, the chancellors, the deans of the graduate school, and other administrative officers from the system campuses meet regularly. So I met two or three times a year at least with the other deans of the graduate school in the system. That's also an area that we worked to improve relations, because when Donna came and appointed her new staff, we were told by system that Madison was greatly resented throughout the UW system for being elitist and not deigning to attend any of these system-wide meetings, on the grounds that we had nothing to learn from anyone else and couldn't be bothered. And so she told all of us that we were expected to attend the system meetings. It was important that we be represented there and that we show a certain amount of respect and solidarity for the rest of the system. We've done that, and I think that's really paid off, too.
In terms of what you've heard about Dean Bach, had he attended those meetings?
No.
Okay.
He usually sent Eric Grudy, I believe.
So all in all, you did not end up really eliminating or consolidating that many programs.
Well, what we did was this, and it's been a long, slow process. Yeah, we did eliminate and consolidate a lot of things, but not usually academic departments. It was more degree programs. When we found that a particular department had four or five differently named PhD programs, we arm-twisted and badgered them into consolidating them into one program. The savings are kind of minimal in terms of dollars, but it streamlines the offerings, it makes it easier for the students to see what's available. It eliminates a lot of questions about what really is the difference between pharmaceutical chemistry and chemical pharmacology and so on. And in fact, that's not a random example. The pharmacy school at one point, I believe, actually literally, numerically, had more differently named graduate degrees than the total number of faculty.
Oh,
more than
goodness.
One different degree per faculty member. And we've now consolidated those down to a more manageable and realistic number.
Now, when programs are added or degrees are added, that is initiated at the departmental or college level?
Yes.
And you get involved at what point?
Or the graduate school? It's a fairly lengthy process that's prescribed by the regents. If a department wants to offer a new degree, they propose it to their college, and the College Academic Planning Council considers it and sometimes says no, and it doesn't go any further. If it makes it through the college level review process, the dean forwards it to the Campus Academic Planning Council for review and recommendation, and they either approve or disapprove it. Usually they approve it if it gets that far. Then we have to go to system and ask for permission to plan. And there's it's called a Format A, a piece of paperwork that we have to do. It's all written out in system regulations and prescribed how we have to describe what we're going to do and what kinds of questions we have to answer. And we have to get external reviews, external comments. And then it's taken to the regents. And the regents get to question us on why is this needed, how much will it cost, what audience does it serve, and so on. And the regents have to consider it at two separate meetings. They have a first reading where they ask their questions and so on, and then sometimes they ask for, they ask questions that no one can answer, so we have to go back and think about it. And then at the very next meeting, they take it up again and either pass it or not.
Now,
that usually takes a couple of years altogether.
I was talking to Martha Casey the other day, and she said she gave me a list of some of the programs that are under 5-year review now, the ones that started when you were when you were dean. And one of them that might be dropped is developmental biology. Could we use that one as sort of an example, like when that program came before the graduate school? How much input do you have into supporting that? Can you fight against having that program? Can you are you there just to support it? How does that work?
Well, I mean, administrators are supposed to do what they can to clear away the underbrush and so on, and help faculty do what they want to do. And presumably, they're proposing this program for good reasons. And so, I normally assume that I'm there to be supportive, unless there's something just glaringly outrageous about it, and usually if there is, I wouldn't be the only one to see it. The committees, the academic planning councils, would see it, and
so by this, it's been vetted by the time you get it, pretty much. Okay.
And I don't really remember, to tell you the truth, the details of the origin of developmental biology. What else is on the list there?
Here, I made an extra copy. This is just what's up for review. Virology never did make it. I guess it was being pushed by Tim, and she just used that as an example of what might have been.
Oh, no. There's one mistake here.
What's that?
Number 4 on your list says Doctor of Pharmacy. Phase out the bachelor's degree, phase in the doctorate. That's called Doctor of Pharmacy. However, it is not a doctorate. It's not a doctoral degree. It's a doctoral level professional degree. So it is explicitly not a PhD in pharmacy. We do have such a thing. We have a PhD in pharmacy. But this is the so-called PharmD, which is the pharmacy analog of the MD, Doctor of Medicine.
I see.
And I do remember that one very well. And that was that was quite controversial. That was driven by the pharmacy profession nationally. They decided, back when I was dean of the grad school, that in the future, to practice pharmacy, you would have to hold a PharmD degree. And so it required that every pharmacy school in the country develop PharmD programs. It added, in principle, 1 year to the length of time that it takes to get the degree. Therefore, it's not cheap. It's the chain drug stores around the country weighed in on the issue. They said this is outrageous. This is going to make pharmacists more expensive for us, and they don't need that extra training. Basically, their argument was this is not fair, and it's not true either. But they argued that basically they hire pharmacists to count out aspirin or something, you know, count pills and dispense them, and they don't need a 6-year program to do that. That never was true, and it isn't true today. I can tell you from personal experience, because my father was a pharmacist. But I think they had a point that this was very much driven by the profession and by to some extent the conflict of interest, that the professionals themselves were insisting that it take longer and cost more to buy your entry credentials, and necessarily that then would have an effect in the, you know, the workings of supply and demand to drive up pharmacist salaries. And that's the suspicion was that that was part of the goal, and if it was, it was successful, because it's happening.
Doesn't that put the graduate school in somewhat an awkward position, though, because this is being forced down from the outside?
Yes, and we considered whether or not to protest it. In the end, we decided that probably the arguments in favor of doing it outweighed the arguments of not doing it. That the profession really was changing, that healthcare costs were getting out of hand, and that there were probably things that are currently done by doctors that could be and would be done in the future by other professionals who are somewhat less expensive, like pharmacists, mm-hmm. nurses, nurse practitioners, paraprofessionals, like physician's assistants and mm-hmm. physical therapists and so on. And so we ultimately decided to do it, and we decided that we would do it by asking the regents for permission to charge a higher tuition for pharmacy, and we would mm-hmm. fund it entirely with new tuition. So that's what we've done. We didn't put a penny of state money or a base budget from the university into that program.
I'd like to ask you a couple questions about something that's one of the black holes in the university for me, and that's indirect costs and cost sharing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you read the latest issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education,
yes,
but
I did.
There's been a major change. I'm trying to find the thing right here.
NSF is being encouraged to stop doing so much, insisting on cost sharing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Was that a problem? Was that a developing problem on cost sharing when
non-stop? Yes, and it was bad and getting worse at that time, and it got dramatically worse under Eric Block's term as director of the NSF.
Eric Block,
yes.
I'm familiar with that term. He was involved with the synchrotron thing. He was one of the program managers, I believe.
He was the director of NSF.
Director of NSF.
At a time when we had some difficulty with the NSF.
Yes.
Well, so what do you want to know about indirect costs and cost sharing?
I just want to know what did any specific problems develop in those areas?
Oh, yes, very much so. During my time in the grad school, there was a huge nationwide controversy over indirect costs that was precipitated by an audit at Stanford University in which it was discovered that I'll just express it the way it appeared in the newspapers.
Okay.
It very likely isn't literally true, but what was alleged is that Stanford was falsifying its indirect cost recovery requests and including for reimbursement things that were not eligible, mm-hmm. like a yacht,
right? Yeah,
and flowers for parties,
oh, yeah,
at the president's residence, and
yeah.
things of that sort. Some of that was there were problems in their record keeping and the way they documented their claims for indirect cost reimbursement. It was never as bad as the press portrayed it, but it was bad enough that it precipitated some congressional hearings on the subject and a huge effort to revise the indirect cost recovery process that would have been catastrophic for every university in the mm-hmm. country that is involved in research, federal research funding. That was the time when Marv Ebel made such important mm-hmm. contributions to working out a satisfactory compromise.
Another issue, another thing that I need to discuss with you is the Council of Graduate Schools. Now, this is a national council made up of accredited universities.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is it? Was the UW a member of that?
And oh yes, we still are.
What was the function of the organization?
Well, it has multiple functions. There are lots of associations of universities that we belong to. That's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the members are essentially every university in the country that grants master's or doctoral degrees mm-hmm. is a member of the CGS, the Council of Graduate Schools. And they provide a forum for getting together, sharing experiences. They provide a certain number of continuing education, mentoring, professional development mm-hmm. programs for people who work in graduate schools and for deans themselves. They have a program for new grad deans that educate them quickly on issues like indirect cost mm-hmm. recovery mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. cost sharing and so on. And we should come back to cost sharing in just a minute.
Okay.
We didn't finish that one. Frankly, I found the CGS to be too big to be useful to us. I went to their meetings many times. Their meetings had an attendance that was in the many, many hundreds of people. Grad deans, associate deans, assistant deans, grad admissions officers. There's a huge mix of people who work in graduate schools. And the very fact that we were indiscriminately thrown together with schools that granted only master's degrees and had a completely different set of problems from the PhD institutions meant that it was a little... You were always had the feeling that about 20% of what was being presented was relevant to us. Now, in contrast, there's another group called the Association of Graduate Schools, the AGS, that is the graduate dean's part of the AAU, the Association of American Universities. That organization is widely criticized as being too elitist, but they control their membership very strictly, and essentially the members are the roughly, I think, 67 or so largest research universities in the country. There are a few exceptions to that. Clark University is a member because they were one of the founders, and at that time, back in turn of the last century, they were a major research university. They are no longer, but they're still a member. No one's ever kicked them out. Catholic University is another example of a relatively small, minor player, frankly, in PhD education, or certainly not what most of us would think of as a research university, but they're still a member. And also there are some rapidly rising state universities that are not members, because until 10 years ago they were sort of community colleges.
Right.
So the membership issue is changing right now as we speak, but still, I don't think they'll ever be wide open to anyone who wants to join the way the CGS is. And furthermore, the AGS has a deans-only rule. The only people who go to their meetings are the dean of the graduate school. You're not allowed to send a substitute. So I found that very valuable. It's how I got to meet and to know all of the grad deans at all of our peer institutions, so that I can pick the phone up and call them, and I know them on a first-name basis. That wouldn't happen at a CGS meeting. The chances of bumping into them even would be too small.
Do either of those organizations engage in lobbying of any kind?
Oh, extensively, yeah. They both have professional staffs of lobbyists
in Washington.
Yeah.
Do we have a lobbyist on campus?
Yes.
Who is
Rhonda Narsetter.
During your administration?
During when I first went to the grad school, it was Mike Williamson. And I believe he was the first ever to have that job description.
New positions.
Yeah. And when he left to go to North Carolina, Rhonda was hired.
Okay. Did her
Mike had other duties as well.
But
he did that as part of his role. Rhonda does nothing but federal relations.
And she's the federal lobby.
Yes.
So she's in Washington
right.
a lot.
Right, yes.
Interesting. Cost sharing, we want to go back to that.
Oh, yeah. The issue there, in case it's hopefully not even understood 50 years from now, is that back at the time when the NSF was established and the federal government got heavily involved in funding research, this is widely attributed to Vannevar Bush's influence in lobbying for and getting a major federal role in funding research at universities. The federal government assumed the responsibility for paying the full costs of research on the grounds that universities didn't have anything in their budget that was earmarked for doing that kind of thing. Our basic mission was teaching students, and whatever we collected in the way of tuition and state support, in the case of state schools, was intended to pay for the instructional mission of the campus. And the feds were buying or sponsoring research, and so they should pay the full cost of research. Now, some of the costs of research are easy to tabulate, like graduate student stipends or bottles of chemicals or faculty salaries, whatever. The additional demands that are placed on our buildings, though, the additional cost of electricity to run the equipment, all those things can't be metered on a project-by-project basis. And so the concept of indirect costs, which was already well known among defense contractors and so on, was was agreed to. And every university was given a cognizant agency to deal with on indirect costs. Ours happens to be the Public Health Service, the Department of Health and Human Services. It's the agency that has NIH in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we negotiate with them on what our indirect cost recovery rate will be. So, the agencies were not supposed to require that we share the costs of doing research. They were supposed to pay for all of it, and early on they did. But as the demand for funds exceeded the supply, mm-hmm. the feds began looking for ways to stretch their dollars so that they wouldn't have to say no so
mm-hmm.
often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And universities, especially universities that weren't very competitive yet, didn't have the very best faculty and didn't have much infrastructure, started trying to improve their competitiveness by saying, well, gee, we may not have the greatest proposal, but if you fund this one, we'll match it.
Hmm.
And that seemed to be attractive to some of the agencies. And so they began a process of not always requiring, but often expecting some cost sharing. And if you think about it, the sources of a budget for a university like this are the state.
Mm-hmm.
And you can think of the money they give us as being a subsidy to keep the tuition low for Wisconsin residents. It's nothing more than that. So the state money, which is for instruction, tuition, which the students pay, and sure as hell they're not mm-hmm. expecting that they're mm-hmm. paying for specific mm-hmm. research projects, so that's for instruction. We get gifts from alumni, but those are always targeted. They endow a professorship mm-hmm. or they endow a scholarship or a piece of a building or something,
yeah.
but they don't give it to us for specific research projects. We get a little program revenue from things like running dormitories and so on, but they break even, they don't make a profit. So there really isn't much money that we have that can be just put on the table as flexible money to cost share on research.
Yeah.
And knowing that, the federal agencies started pressuring us to use the indirect cost money or to mm-hmm. use our patent royalty money, the Wharf money.
Oh my.
To cost share with them on specific projects. And we've resisted that mightily, as much as we could. Both of those forms of cost sharing. In the case of indirect costs, just to make it clear, if you travel on university business that we agree to pay for, when you get back, you will submit your expenses and you'll get a reimbursement check. That's exactly analogous to indirect costs.
Mm.
That was your money that you spent taking the trip, and it's your money when we give it back to you in the form of a reimbursement check. Indirect costs are exactly the same. We pay the electricity bills, and we pay for maintenance of the buildings, and we pay for all the other things that are included in our indirect costs. And we tally up all that we spent on those things, and we submit the bill to our cognizant agency, and they agree to it. Usually they disallow a few things, but they agree to it in essence, and then tell us, you'll get your reimbursement by charging us 44% on all of your grants next mm-hmm. year. So that money we get back as indirect costs is truly a reimbursement. It's indirect mm-hmm. cost recovery. It was our money in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's our money when we get it back. And it's already been spent, basically. We're just being reimbursed. So to have us turn around and use that to give back in some formulaic way as cost sharing is fraudulent.
Yeah, right.
And that's
yeah.
what they've been encouraging us yeah. to do. So I'm very happy to see that the NSF is being reined in and told to
Who's reining them in?
I think it's Congress.
Hmm.
They've had enough complaints from universities.
Yeah, this was based on, didn't Clinton set up a committee about a year
yeah.
ago to look at this? We just have a few minutes left. I have a few more questions I want to ask. You talked last time about the Gorman Report and how you got in a little bit of trouble with Dean Bach by quoting from the Gorman Report. And in our interview last year, you talked a little bit about some of the work you've been doing on the impact of rating service. Rating of programs and within a college, how significant is this in terms of the university itself? Does it play a significant role? Is it that good for PR? Is it something that you think is worth paying any attention to?
Well, there are two answers, and they're exactly opposite. I think these ratings, by and large, are almost completely worthless in terms of conveying useful information.
Mm-hmm.
Your idea of the best physics department in the country and mine may be very different,
mm-hmm.
and there's no objective way to say that you're right and I'm wrong. Now, we can cook up some formula to count those things that can be counted and agree on a scoring system and tally up scores for two different physics departments, and one will be higher than the other. Exactly how you weight mm-hmm. the various components will determine which one is better than mm-hmm. which other one, and that's purely subjective.
Mm-hmm.
But once we've agreed on a scoring system, we can come up with scores for every physics department in mm-hmm. the country, and then we can take those scores and sort them from the highest to the lowest and number them one through mm-hmm. n, and that's the ranking.
And you were going to put that on the web.
Well,
did you
actually
ever do that?
Yeah, the National Research Council does this in a way that is pretty systematic and respectable.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it once every 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
We pay a lot of attention to that. We get a lot mm-hmm. of useful feedback from it by looking at the subscores and the elements that go into the overall scores. The reason I studied it, though, is because there's a lot more information in the subscores and the details than there is in the ranking mm-hmm. that comes out at the end. These aren't one-dimensional things that can be arrayed on a one-dimensional scale in any really useful way. So you've got to look at all of the internal dimensions that have been averaged out to get the rankings. And what I wanted to do was establish in a quantitative way confidence limits
yeah,
for every rank.
The confidence, right.
So while it may be true that our
computer science might be
yeah,
right,
it may be true that computer science is ranked number 10 in the country by the National Research Council, I'd like to know how confident are we that it's really number 10?
Yeah.
What's the probability that it could be really number 5 or number 15? And that will vary for every single department on the campus, because while there are 200 or more chemistry departments that get ranked, there are only 20 or so mm-hmm. classics departments. And being number 10 out of 200 is very different from being number 10 out of 20. Furthermore, if all the astronomy departments get scores of 4.8 or above out of 5, and then you rank them, that's a very different
mm-hmm,
thing
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
than having all the departments get scores that range from 0 to 5 and ranking them. So I employed a recent graduate of the math department to work with me, and we wrote a computer program that did numerical simulations of all of the rankings that the NRC had done, and we put the results up on the web. So anyone can see now what the confidence limits are for every ranked department mm-hmm. in every field that they rank nationwide.
Yeah, sometimes I get a little scared when I listen to some of my graduate students who work for me. They take these rankings incredibly seriously, and it determines where they might want to go for a postdoc
well,
or something
you
like
you
that.
You want to just take a look at the history department and see what we can see by looking at the graph?
Sure.
This is the NRC's report. It's a fat tome, about 2.5 inches thick, and it's chock full of data. This is a 740-page book, but the only thing anyone ever pays attention to is Appendix Q. Appendix Q has the scholarly quality of programs, and they're alphabetical. So here's history. And according to this, what you see here now is the score that they got from 0 to 5. The highest score is Yale University, mm-hmm. and they're ranked number 1 in the country. And there's an error bar given on their score, but no error bar given vertically, which would determine their ordinal rank.
Mm-hmm.
So let's find Wisconsin. We're ranked 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10th in the country. With error bars that overlap, you can get a rough idea mm-hmm. of this from the error bars. The error bar overlaps with the number 5 rated program, Columbia, mm-hmm. and also with the number 13 rated program, Cornell.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's no overlap with the 14th program. So we can be pretty confident that we're in the first 13.
Mm-hmm.
We could be as high as maybe a fifth or so.
Yeah.
In fact, I think, let me look at my actual calculations.
Very interesting. We're ahead of Michigan.
Yeah. According to my calculations, there's a 1% chance that we're 6th or above, and a 1% chance that we're 13th or below.
Hmm.
We have a 50-50 chance of being 9th. My judgment here would be that we're definitely between, or very, very likely to be between 8th and 11th right now.
That's great.
Now, if you look at some other departments, the spreads are just phenomenal. Physiology is one that's just out to lunch. I won't go through it here, but as a matter of fact, I do happen to remember that in the physiology rankings, there's an anomalous program. The University of Alaska is ranked 102nd, 102. But because of the subtleties of the interactions among ranks when programs move around, there's actually a better chance that they're number one in the country than there is that they're between 7th or 8th in the country. Because all of the programs in the range around 3rd to 10th or something like that have scores that are so similar that they're just this very densely packed group, and the probability of landing in that pack is just too low.
My goodness. Amazing.
But to get back to the reason for your question, we have to pay attention to this because everyone else does.
Yeah,
you're exactly right. Graduate students pay attention to it. Parents take it into account when they advise their kids on where to go to school. Alumni badger us nonstop. If we go down in the rankings as published by U.S. News or Business Week.
And you can't tell me departments don't pay attention to it.
Departments pay attention to it. Everyone pays attention to it. So we have to. But is it really objectively meaningful? No.
Hmm.
Furthermore, the existence of these rankings by the popular press, like U.S. News and Business Week and so on, leads some universities, we have not done this, but some universities have done things just for the purpose of increasing their rankings.
Yeah.
And I'll give you some examples of the kinds of destructive things that you have to do. You look at their formulas and say, okay, what would it take to get our score higher in this area? One example for undergraduate programs is selectivity. If you reject a larger fraction of your applicants, your score for selectivity will go up. That's a surrogate for quality. The more selective you are, the higher your quality your program is the reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to improve our ranking would be to really aggressively recruit applicants around the state, including people that we know we're going to reject.
How cynical, yeah.
So that we would have appear to be more selective.
Interesting.
To give another example, and by the way, that's one of the reasons that we don't do very well in the rankings for undergraduate programs, because we admit about 80% of the applicants in the state. But we do that by advising them very carefully what it mm-hmm. takes to get in here. And if they don't think we're going to admit them, they don't apply.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just fine.
Mm-hmm.
So another example is the following line of reasoning. The best schools will have the best faculty. The best faculty will be in high demand. If they're in high demand, supply and demand will drive their salaries up. So faculty salaries should scale with faculty quality.
Mm-hmm.
That means that we could improve our rankings overnight by raising all the faculty salaries. That would not change our quality one bit. I mean, I'm sure all the faculty would be happy to have us do that, but they'd all be the same people the next day. They'd just be earning more, and our ratings would go up.
Yeah.
It's that silly.
Yeah. And we're stuck in a culture, the USA Today culture, the top 10 this, the top 10 that. Every day that those lists are just maddening.
I'll give you a copy of my paper.
Okay, great. we have 2 minutes left, and we're going to finish on time. I'm going to give you the last word. Do you want to make any closing comments about your career, your years in the graduate school as dean?
Well, I guess in 2 minutes I would just say that I think it's widely believed around the campus, and I can confirm that it's true, that the best job on campus is being a faculty member. with no administrative duties. The second best by far, and the best of all the administrative jobs, is being dean of the graduate school. It's a really interesting job. Your day is filled with meeting and talking to faculty and hearing about interesting research results, dealing with issues that are right at the cutting edge. There wasn't a day that went by that I didn't learn something new that I actually wanted to learn. Meeting with site visit teams for proposals that were about to be funded. It was just a lot of fun. Most of the administrative jobs on campus deal more with personnel issues, mediating disputes, mm-hmm. Giving depositions for lawsuits, things of that sort, and there's blessedly little of that in the graduate school. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.